of the federal health care reform proposals. And I would ask the members of the committee to understand this is an education session. I would also ask you to understand that there are four separate bills in the House that are all different that have not been combined yet. And while the HELP Committee in the Senate has voted out a bill, it isn't in printed form, and the Finance Committee bill in the Senate is not available yet. So there are a lot of things that could change, and I'm sure that when the Congress comes back from their recess, they'll be refining this. So this is the current state of things. And but I'm sure we'll get an overview of most of the issues that are being discussed. Dr. Blewett, welcome.
Thank you much, Senator Berglund, for inviting me this morning. It's a great opportunity to share with you what we know, and there are many things we don't know, but we've tried to prepare some information for you on what's going on in the national health reform debate. Jean Abraham is here with me from the university. I'm going to provide an overview of what's moving, and she's going to provide some detail on the public plan option and the financing. And Jean just spent a year in Washington with the Council of Economic Advisors and just came back in June, so she's got a kind of a firsthand look at what's happening in Washington. So I'm going to talk about the key proposals, broad implications, the legislative process, payment reform, and state role in health reform. So the three major bills that are moving through the Congress are Senator Kennedy's Affordable Health Choices Act, and sometimes you hear that called the HELP Committee, which is health, education, labor, and pensions. The Senate Finance Committee draft proposal, that's not actually a bill that's been introduced, but the proposal is, we put this on because it's Senator Baucus who's chair of the Finance Committee, and the HELP bill has to go through the Finance Committee. And he has a gang of six, three Democrats, three Republicans, and is trying to introduce a bipartisan bill out of the Senate within in September. And then the House Tri-Committee bill, America's Affordable Health Choices Act, we're going to take some of the key provisions. As Senator Berglund said, there are three or four House bills that are moving, but this is kind of the main elements of this particular bill. The key elements of health reform are listed here: the public insurance option, insurance exchange, individual mandate, employer mandate, guaranteed issue, and premium subsidy. And I'm going to go through each of these fairly quickly so we can move into the discussion. But as you can see, all of the bills have an insurance exchange. All of them have an individual mandate, guaranteed issue, and premium subsidies. And the two things that the Baucus and Finance have not committed to in their proposals are the public insurance option and the employer mandate. So on the public insurance option, as I said, the Kennedy HELP bill has a public insurance option. The Tri-Committee bill, the House bill, has a public insurance option. The key issues there is who would run the public insurance option and how much control they would have over payment and negotiation of provider fees. So in the House Tri-Committee bill, which is probably the most government-oriented, it's run by DHHS, and they will pay Medicare rates under the Tri-Committee bill. Under the Baucus Finance, they've talked about consumer cooperatives, and you may have read the Star Tribune this morning. There was an article on cooperatives, which would be a nonprofit cooperation by competitive bid. The insurance exchange, so this is an exchange where you'd go to find health insurance if you're an individual or small employer. So this is an organizing entity that would organize health insurance. All the provisions have this. It's modeled on the Massachusetts exchange, the connector in Massachusetts. Again, it kind of depends, the questions here, on who is going to run the exchange. Is it going to be a national exchange? Is it going to be state-based? There's some talk on in terms of in the Kennedy HELP bill that might be state or even regional. There might be competing exchanges. And so as we go through this, there's a lot of the devil is in the details, and there aren't a lot of details in the bills. So the just broad general strategy on how they would approach it. But they all think they all have exchange as part of the reform option. The individual mandate, so this again is modeled after Massachusetts, which requires all individuals to have health insurance coverage. It's like the automobile mandate where everybody has to have car insurance coverage. They all have an individual mandate. The issue here is what the penalty would be if you didn't purchase insurance, a credible insurance coverage. So there's two issues. What is credible insurance? So what are the minimum benefits set? Who decides what that benefit set is? And then what the penalty is if you don't purchase it. So in the Kennedy Help Bill, the penalty is based on the cost of that credible coverage in your area. The Baucus fine assesses average cost of insurance, and the House Tri-Committee bill bases it on your income. So again, if you're at lower income, you'd likely pay a lower penalty. So again, the detail is who's going to make those decisions on the essential benefit set and how the penalty will be decided. And again, these are the three ideas on the table which will eventually come up through the political process in conference committee as you've all participated in. But these are the proposals on the table. The employer mandate, and in the old days we used to call this pay or play, you either purchase coverage for your employees, or you pay a penalty. So this requires all employers to pay to provide health insurance coverage or to contribute to a fund. And again, the question is, how much do employers have to pay a percent of the premium? And as you can see in the Kennedy Help Bill, the employers would be required to pay 60% of the premium, of the family premium, or $750 for each employee who is not offered coverage. So the penalty there is not very high, $750 per employee per year. The Baucus Finance Committee does not have employer mandate. They do have what's called this free rider provision, which is pretty interesting, which is if you're an employee and employer and your employees are on either a public plan like Minnesota Care or Medicaid, you would have to pay the government for that insurance coverage. So rather than you're riding free on the government, you're paying low enough wages that they qualify for a public program. The House Tri-Committee bill is similar to the Kennedy Help bill, which is the employer must pay 65% of family premiums. So as you may recall, in Minnesota Care, we require employers to pay 50%, so it's a higher contribution rate. And then small businesses are exempt, and payrolls less than $750,000 are reduced competition. So these are some of the details and elements that will be discussed and moving through. They're probably drowned out by other issues right now in terms of the national debate, but these are the details that staff is working very hard on coming to consensus on. The other kind of main provision, again, it's in all of the three bills moving through the Congress, is guaranteed issue and rating provisions. So guaranteed issue is that all insurance plans, private or public, would have to accept you if you go to them and ask for insurance. Right now there's underwriting, and they can deny you coverage or can charge an exorbitant premium based on your health condition. In this, the insurance companies have agreed that they would do guaranteed issues, so everybody would have access to coverage. The key to that then is what can they rate on, and so how do you set the premium? And again, every bill is a little bit different. The Kennedy Help Bill says you can't rate on health status, you can't rate on gender, class of business, claims experience. So again, it's moving toward a more uniform community rate as opposed to experience rating. Baucus Finance Committee just mentions health status, no rating on health status. And then the Tri-Committee has health status, gender, and occupation. So again, this is the insurance reform part of the bill. The main access expansion is, in addition to the exchange, is the expanded Medicaid eligibility. So right now, adults without children are in many states not eligible for any Medicaid coverage, and this would set a minimum standard across the whole country, and then there's different rates of what that minimum standard would be based on the federal poverty level. So Kennedy has 150%, so everybody up to 150% of the federal poverty. Baucus is at 100, and the House Tri-Committee is 133%. So this is an expansion of Medicaid primarily for single adults. Most pregnant mothers and children are already covered at that level, and as you know, Minnesota Care can go up to 250 to 300% of poverty. So this is mainly for single adults. Just on the House Tri-Committee, there's a couple of details in how they would do this. In the Kennedy Health Bill, they don't have an asset test, for example. And the Tri-Committee Bill, they have the increase in the Medicaid payment rates to match Medicare. So there's, again, some provision around payment to providers. So the premium subsidies, this is another component of the access provision. So if you're not eligible for Medicaid, you may be eligible for a premium subsidy, which is basically a tax credit based, again, on income. So, and this would be a sliding scale. You would pay a certain proportion of the premium, and the government would pay part of that premium. So again, the benchmark is based on the federal poverty level. So this would be Kennedy Health Bill, you're at 150%, you're qualified for Medicaid. If you're at 300% of FPL, you would qualify for a tax credit and the premium subsidy. Again, sort of how those credits are going to be based and what the credible coverage is to determine what those premiums are, again, is going to be a big political debate and a consensus building process in terms of what that credible minimum benefit set is. Okay. This is just an example of the access expansion. So if you see the light blue is the Medicaid expansion, and then the darker blue is the premium subsidy. So this is the main access expansion of all three bills that are moving. And so the highest is up to 400% of the federal poverty level, combining Medicaid and then the tax credit for the premium subsidies. And again, just remember those premium subsidies are also income related. So as you move up the income scale, you would be paid more of the premium. I'm going to just do a couple impact slides, and Jean is going to talk a little bit about the financing. And many of you have heard the dollar amounts, which are not trivial. So they go from $1 trillion Baucus Finance, $900 billion, to up to 1.3. I think there was also a 1.6 trillion. The House Tri-Committee tried to get back to the $1 trillion figure. That seems to be the figure people are trying to target. It's a significant amount of federal funding. And in terms of the number of uninsured, currently there are 46 million uninsured, and even with these access expansions, there's still going to be a significant number of uninsured. So on the Kennedy Help Bill, we reduced that by 10 million. On the House Tri-Committee, we reduced the number of uninsured to 17 million. So, and then their estimates, CBO estimates, without anything happening, that by 2019 there'd be 53 million uninsured. So while there's a significant movement in access, there's still going to be a lot of people without coverage. So the legislative process, and there's a lot of lobbyists in the room that may be able to speak to some of the political process, but this is what I understand that's happening, is that there's August recess, and all the members are back in their districts going to their town hall meetings. The Help Committee bill, the House bill, was approved and passed out of the committee, and said this is Senate and sent to finance. The Finance Committee has jurisdiction over any payment or Medicare, any fiscal Medicare, Medicaid ramifications. So the Kennedy bill has to go through finance, which is why we included the Baucus provisions, because Baucus is the chair of the Finance Committee, so he's really trying to get a bipartisan approach through the Finance Committee. The House Committee bills are marked up, and at the end of your packet should be a kind of a visual of the players with their little, who the players are and how things are moving through the Congress. So the hope is by, again, when they come back from session, that this Finance Committee will have their proposal on the table, and then there'll be the process of going to the floors of both chambers and then to Congress. Oh, this is the one. So that should be like full page where you can kind of take a look. And the bottom line is the president said he hopes to sign a legislation by the end of the year. The last resort, which I haven't heard too much about lately, but there is a kind of a fallback position, which is budget reconciliation process. So this is a legislative procedural movement that you can pass a bill through budget reconciliation, which can be passed on a Democratic vote if they have the votes. It's not clear that they do. This is a bill that cannot be filibustered, and it doesn't need, they can do it, I think it's with the 60 requirements of the Democratic vote. So that's kind of in their back pocket. If they can't get a bipartisan bill and Obama really wants to push something through, there's this budget reconciliation procedure that they can use. The problem with it is that it is it has a five-year sunset provision. So remember, SCHIP was passed, or the SCHIP program was passed on a budget reconciliation bill, and so after 5 years it had to be reauthorized. So that's where we had this reauthorization and the debate. And so that's a risk you take, is that after 5 years it would be renegotiated and reauthorized. And then there's what's called the Byrd rule, which is basically you can't do any policy provisions in a budget reconciliation bill. It has to all do with revenue and expenditures. You can't do policy. So that would mean you technically couldn't do the insurance provisions under a budget reconciliation, which is all policy. It's not necessarily revenue. It's how you set your rates, guaranteed issue. And so there's some concern that you would lose that component of the process of the bills. Payment reform, I guess there's limited, if not any, discussion, substantive discussion of payment reform. So they cite the HIT, the stimulus funds that are cited as a mechanism to increase efficiency. They have made available stimulus funding for health information technology to improve efficiency. The proposals mostly include blunt adjustments to payments and payment formulas, so it's basically cuts to pay Medicare payments or cuts in the rate of growth of Medicare payments. So there isn't a lot of talk about reforming how those payments are made. President Obama does make mention of the use of the MedPAC, which is a medical advisory committee which informs Congress on the Medicare program. And they do a lot of statistical and very detailed work on the financing and payment methodologies for Medicare. And he has made mention that might be a good vehicle or a good body to look at payment reform under health reform. The proposed payment reform, I've re-termed that cuts, and it's a vehicle for how they're going to finance health reform. So $500 billion of changes to Medicare over 10 years. So they propose to charge wealthy seniors more for prescription drugs, reducing payments to the Medicare Advantage plans, that's the HMO plans under Medicare, and trimming the projected payments to hospitals by $155 billion. And they are proposing, this is in one of the bills, an independent commission powered to cut Medicare spending to pre-savings targets. This would not be Medicaid. This would not be MedPAC. This would be a new provision. There are a lot of other more detailed finance provisions, but basically what they're doing is just kind of cutting or slowing the rate of growth to get additional revenue to pay for the reform. I'm just going to mention a few of the MedPAC proposals because they do represent some of the work Minnesota is doing in terms of their reform. So just to make sure that you don't think Minnesota's out of the framework of what could be discussed on payment reform. So the MedPAC, and they release a report every spring which provides recommendations to the Congress, and they have promoted the use of accountable healthcare organizations. So those are organizations that can take risk, provider and physicians groups. They want to restructure the Medicare benefits, align incentives for cost and quality targets to pay for quality care, for value-based care. Again, there's agreement to reduce Medicare or payments to Medicare Advantage and incentivize innovation. The accountable care organizations could be a potential pilot under Medicare, which basically it's physician groups working with other providers, so in physicians and hospital organizations, and they would get incentive payments to reach performance targets based on illness or diagnosis. I just included some additional information on payment reform, which includes, and some of the things that they've advised are medical home, transparency, peer grouping, reducing unnecessary admissions. So there are people in Washington thinking about payment reform and how to restructure to increase the quality and reduce inefficiencies. It's just not the debate that's happening in the bills that are moving through Congress. So the payment reform is likely going to happen later. It's not going to be part of the bill, partly because it's very detailed and complicated and likely going to be an expert panel or an expert group that makes those recommendations. And MedPAC, who's already made that first foray into this area, is probably going to be one of the leaders in that discussion. So the state role in health reform could be potentially substantial. So if you think about it, they're basing their access expansions off a Medicaid expansion, which is a state-based program. So there could be new screening and enrollment requirements. There's going to be some federal match. The House said we'll do, when they first came out, they said they would do 100% federal match for the expansion. Now they backed down from that, so it's likely not going to be 100%. So states will have to, come up with the money to fund that expansion for the matching payment. There could be some administration and finance wraparound benefits if they're lower than our current Medicaid program, if the state decides to do that. And currently, there are no financing provisions in any of the budget proposals for state administration. So when they have the Medicaid expansion, they're costing out the match, but they're not costing out anything else. They're not costing out the insurance reform or any other component of the expansion. The premium subsidies, which is basically a tax credit, could be done through, that's again based on income. So someone has to assess income eligibility, which has typically been a Medicaid program. So who's going to do that application process for the premium subsidy? You can do it through tax credit through the Department of Revenue in your tax form, and you staple your credible certificate from your insurance company. But in terms of what kind of subsidy are you going to get? If you're looking at assets, income, and it can get very complicated, which means who's going to do that and who's going to fund the state to do that program. Insurance exchange, that could be a national exchange or it could be a state-based exchange. So Massachusetts has their own exchange. Minnesota's talked about an exchange. And it's basically a brokering agency, typically a private nonprofit that would organize insurance plans, and it'd be a place one-stop shopping to go. So this is this is the minimum benefit set, this is the next tier, this is the next tier, and here's how much they cost. If it's a state exchange, there would be some need for creation of an infrastructure within federal requirements. At least one bill said that would be funded by 4% of the premium, so it would be a premium tax. Again, that's an implication for state insurance companies. On the public plan implementation, again, it's not clear if that would be administered at the federal level. Do you apply at the federal level? Who's going to do the income eligibility? Will that be done at the state level? So, again, a lot of this stuff of if you pass it, how are you going to implement it? And at that point, they're going to look to the states and say, okay, we've done it, let's go. And they're just really, I don't see a lot of state input at this point in the process. Insurance reform, there's going to be new rating regulations. It's likely to be different than what we currently have. There may be enforcement of the individual mandate. So who's going to enforce that individual mandate? Who's going to assess the penalty? If the penalty is based on income, how is that going to be determined? So that could be a new role for the Department of Revenue in terms of administering social policy through the tax structure. And then enforcing the national minimum benefit requirements. If that's a national minimum benefit, that the states would have to comply with. Other state role, I just pulled out a couple things that I think the state should be aware of, which are, there could be significant Medicare cuts to providers, which would be pressure on physicians and hospitals and potential access problems for Medicare beneficiaries, and additional pressure for safety net providers. So, Medicare and Medicaid are a substantial part of many hospital and providers' revenue, and cuts to those programs will have an impact. And then the Medicare cuts to the Medicare Advantage plan, again, might reduce options for seniors and dual eligibles. And then there are also proposals to cut disproportionate share payments. So those are Medicaid and Medicare payments to hospitals that provide a disproportionate share of care to the poor and uninsured. And that comes through the Medicare payment and the Medicaid payment. And so those are typically HCMC, Regions, University, anybody who does care for the poor and uninsured. Those, the idea is as you get more people covered, you shouldn't need that extra financing for caring for the uninsured because they'll be less uninsured. That's the rationale. So there is some concern about state infrastructure. It's probably the worst time to implement healthcare reform. I mean, the states, this is a first quarter tax revenue declined in 45 of the 47 early reporting states. Personal income tax fell 15.8%. That's a national average. States face $183 billion in budget shortfalls between now and 2011. And they've already addressed the $46 billion budget gaps. And Minnesota has done its share in terms of trying to address the budget gap. And so the state infrastructure is stressed, and how many of these proposals will be implemented is a concern. This is just a visual. The last time we had a recession and there was some pressure on the state budget was in 2002 to 2005. These are national figures and projections out to 2011. So we should be closer to the zero line. We're deficit spending, and as you know, the states can't deficit spend, so those are budget gaps that they have to fill. Another thing just to be reminded of, this is the distribution of the general fund resources in the state of Minnesota, and 31% goes to health and human services, so there's concern about expanding that even further with the Medicaid expansions without federal support for financial participation. And then this is the Medicaid spending projection, which is a national average, which is expected to increase 8% annually, which is, you know, more than two or three times the rate of inflation, increase in inflation. So the concern is with Medicaid taking a greater share of state budgets and more pressure to include more people on those budgets, and without more financial support, it's just going to be a lot of pressure on the state general fund budget into the future. Just a few words on Minnesota reform strategy. Minnesota is well positioned, and I think as they move, if they pass a bill and they start to discuss system reform and payment reform, Minnesota's passed a lot of those provisions and are moving ahead with that, and I think we're in a good position to inform some of those discussion. There's been key action here on measurement, transparency, provider peer grouping, financial incentives, and the equality health requirements will help with providers getting the stimulus funding that's available for HIT funding. Many of you know what the reform is. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but another thing in one of the bills was based on this these grants that the CHIP program did in Minnesota was to provide grants to communities for reduce obesity and tobacco. So those are community grants to improve the health of populations. That provision is in one of the bills. The medical home is in one of the bills, so we're already moving ahead on that provision, and also this data collection and peer grouping for quality and cost measurement. And then the other part that Minnesota is doing is on the establishing the baskets of care. So again, it's like thinking about how to pay for services in a more efficient manner, and then again the use of electronic health records. States, you know, we do a lot of work with states at the University of Minnesota across the country, and we're finding that states are still doing reform. Even though there hasn't been a lot of national leadership, not a lot of national funding, states are still doing reform around the edges, and so you see Minnesota's systems reform. There are 12 states who are doing Cover All Kids initiatives. So there is movement in the states across the country, but really right now we can't do more without additional resources. There just isn't any funds either at the state or national level. So it's sort of, you know, incremental steps forward. Universal coverage will likely require federal action. If you have an individual mandate or an employer mandate to get around ERISA, which basically preempts state regulation, you would need to have the federal government intervene in those particular areas. There's limited discussion of state role and costs. I suppose that's will be discussed when they're talking about implementation, and maybe now we're talking about big picture framework issues, so that'll likely come later, but I think we'll be talking about these things for a few years. So the big hurdles are the public plan, which, you know, changes every day. So you read the paper and hear what's going on. And is it in? Is it out? Is it partly in? Is it co-ops? And Jean is going to talk a little bit about the public plan and the financing. And then my best guess for now is if President Obama is insistent on getting a bill out, it'll be a high-level framework. It'll be probably those access expansions, some insurance reform, high-level framework for how to move forward, but a lot of details still to be decided. And there's just a little visual, which Obama's saying, hurry up, and the Congress saying, what's the rush, and the uninsured continue to fall. So I'll have Jean. Would you like Jean to go and then
yes,
take questions?
Yes, I thought we'd ask okay. you both questions okay. after she's
that
done.
That sounds good.
Good morning, Senator Berglund and others. Thank you very much for having me here today. As Dr. Blewett alluded to at the beginning of her talk, I bring kind of a unique perspective to federal health reform discussions, having just returned from a one-year term serving as the senior economist on healthcare on the President's Council of Economic Advisors in Washington, D.C. And while in that role, I served as an active participant in the development of the Obama administration's policies and positions on key elements of the reform, including the public plan, payer play, and subsidy schedule. And during that time, I also co-authored a study on the economic case for healthcare reform. I do want to emphasize that today my views represent those as a health economist and professor at the University of Minnesota. So for my presentation today, I'm going to talk about three topics: the public plan, which, as Lynn said, is changing day by day. The employer-payer play, also known as the employer-shared responsibility, requirements that are being put forth, and the financing of healthcare reform, which is causing a tremendous amount of discussion around whether we can afford to do this. So let me begin with the public plan option. So when we think about a public option, it really entails kind of two characteristics. One, that a governmental organization bears financial risk for the cost of individuals who enroll in that plan, and that the governmental organization either administers directly or contracts with a private third party to administer the health plan. And in the early part of the discussion, there was really no consensus around what constituted a public plan, from an integrated delivery system like the Veterans Administration to the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, which many would actually classify as an employer plan. Really, there are two rationales for having a public insurance option. The first is to increase consumer choice. If one does polling of likely voters, they'll find that individuals, for the most part, are not particularly pleased with private health insurers. And for many, not all, but for some, public option is perceived as safer and more reliable as far as health insurance goes. The second and perhaps more kind of economically important rationale is that it has the potential to drive down costs, both with respect to administrative costs as well as provider unit costs. And proponents of a public option argue that it may help, entry by a public option may help to deal with some of the issues arising as a result of increased concentration of market power by insurers and specialty physician groups in local geographic areas. We've seen this particularly over the past decade. In many local markets, insurers have tremendous market power. They're very concentrated. A study by the American Medical Association found that 76% of 313 MSAs had at least one insurer that had more than 50% of PPO's market share, preferred provider organizations are the most dominant form of health insurance product. There are entry barriers for private insurers, particularly fairly high fixed costs around provider network development, and so some see a public option as helping to overcome that. There's also an issue layered upon this, which is that we've seen tremendous consolidation among certain specialty provider groups in local markets, particularly following the managed care backlash in the 1990s. Many physician groups merged together in order to improve their leveraging or bargaining power with insurers. And the result has been higher provider payment rates that in some cases have been passed on to insurers in the form of higher premiums, to consumers in the form of higher premiums. I want to talk briefly about the two ways in which a public plan could drive down costs. And the first is by lowering administrative costs. And this chart is simply an illustration of the administrative costs as a percent of premium, comparing what a private plan could potentially do in an insurance exchange environment relative to a public plan. And what you'll see is that the components or the cost components of administration for both the private plan and the public plan are similar for most of the elements. The main distinction revolves around the distribution of coverage. So this would be the broker's fees that are often part of private plan premiums in the individual market. Those would likely be lower from the public plan's perspective. And the margin issue, that a public plan has no profit motive and therefore would have a lower margin. Again, just want to emphasize that there is tremendous variability across health plans with respect to their administrative costs. And in fact, Minnesota tends to do better than other parts of the country on this. So a public plan could potentially have lower administrative costs as a result of scale and lack of profit motive. They could also potentially lower costs as a result of negotiating harder with providers, so lowering provider unit costs. And the chart on the right just simply illustrates the difference in hospital margins by payer. And what we see here is that commercial payers, commercial payers reimburse at the highest rate, followed by Medicare, Medicaid, and the uninsured. And so to the extent that the public plan targets their provider unit costs toward Medicare provider rates, they can squeeze providers to lower health plan premiums. So let me move to presenting kind of a chart that illustrates or contrasts the three public plan options or alternatives currently being debated. And Lynn particularly talked about the House Tri-Committee version and the Senate HELP bill. As you can see there, the government in both cases bears the risk of the costs associated with enrollees' healthcare consumption and administration. Both the House and the Senate HELP bills provide or allow for the Department of Health and Human Services to administer the plan. The distinction between those two with respect to administration is a little bit difficult to see in the language. In terms of provider payment rates, we see that this is an important part of how effective a public plan could be at controlling costs. And the House committee bill basically sets those rates at Medicare plus some multiplier. And we saw in the markup process that there was a change made where those rates would be negotiated, presumably as a result of pushback from physician trade groups. Similarly, in the Senate HELP bill, we see that the Secretary of HHS would negotiate and that those rates could go up as high as average private plan rates. So there's been some concessions around the language of how hard a public plan option would bargain. I want to also mention this co-op model, which has been pushed quite heavily in the last week or so. And this is not a public plan, per se. It is a private, consumer-governed nonprofit corporation. And the role of government in this, with respect to this model, would be in the form of federal seed money, in the form of grants and loans that would help private co-ops to overcome some of the startup costs for getting off the ground. We don't have a lot of detail around co-ops. We do have a few models across the country. The Group Health in Seattle, as well as Health Partners in our own backyard, are two examples. I think there needs to be considerably more detail fleshed out as to whether we think there's a good business case for this model providing kind of having the comparative advantage for helping to keep costs down. So this just simply shows the trade-off between the public plan kind of objectives, maximizing cost savings or maximizing choice, and I think we are moving in the direction of maximizing choice. Of course, the result remains to be seen with what plays out. The second topic that I'd like to spend a little bit of time on is the employer payer play or employer shared responsibility provision that has been included in each of the bills. Just to give you kind of an update on current statistics, employer-sponsored insurance is still the dominant form of private health insurance for non-elderly Americans, covering about 60% of the population. That number is probably slightly lower now, given the economic recession. We know that firm size is by far the most important determinant of whether or not a worker has health insurance through his or her firm. And we know that there's also a distinction between workers who, depending on how much they work, part-time workers are much less likely to have an offer of employer-sponsored coverage. Even in firms that offer insurance, only 31% of part-time workers are eligible to enroll. And finally, low-wage workers, those who are most likely to benefit from the current reform coverage expansion proposals, are much less likely to either have an offer of coverage or take it up. So this slide just kind of reiterates what Lynn had mentioned. The coverage expansion proposals really go quite a ways up the income distribution, providing a Medicaid eligibility expansion up to 150% of poverty under the Senate Help Bill, with income subsidies proposed for purchasing health insurance within the exchange up to between 300 and 400% of poverty, depending on the particular bill. I mean, basically, we have a lot of uninsured Americans who would qualify for either Medicaid or subsidized coverage. And so from the policymakers' perspective, it's important to think about what implications this has for either worker decision-making or employer decision-making. So kind of if we want to kind of formalize what is employer play, it basically is simply a provision that requires employers of a certain size to offer health insurance to its workers or to pay to help finance subsidies for those without access. Basically, it's designed to help prevent the erosion of employer-sponsored insurance, which has been in slow decline since the early 2000s, and it's an important revenue source for paying for health care reform. So Lynn has already presented this in a more elegant display than my bullets, but essentially the two bills that are the full draft language, for which we have the full draft language, basically indicate modestly sized payer plays. The House Tri-Committee bases theirs on a percentage of payroll scaled for part-time workers. They also include provisions around a minimum kind of level of coverage as well as a minimum contribution that an employer must make toward the total premium, set at 72.5% for single coverage and 65% for family coverage. Just as reference, those are currently set, those thresholds are actually fairly, they're not likely to bind for most employers right now, but over time that actually could be more relevant. And the House Tri-Committee bill also includes a small employer and hardship exemption. For Senate help, it's a flat dollar amount, which is not very much, and depending on how that's indexed, that could erode over time since healthcare costs are growing faster than other forms of compensation. And it also provides for a small firm exemption classified as number of workers. So one thing that, while at the council that we worked on, that the economists focused on, was thinking about the interaction of employer-payer play provisions with other policies being proposed, in particular the subsidy schedule and the exchange, and the relationship between access to the exchange and access to having an offer of employer-sponsored insurance. From the worker's perspective, as this goes forward, if a particular worker has an offer of coverage through his or her employer, you know, they're going to weigh their alternative options regarding compensation, including take-home wages and health insurance. And their decision to take up that offer of health insurance is going to be contingent on what the employer requires them to pay out of pocket, as well as potentially how much they value health insurance, their information about their health status and needs for coverage. One thing that I think the administration and congressional staffs have spent a lot of time thinking about is what happens to those workers, particularly low-wage workers who have an offer of coverage, if they might be better off in the exchange with heavily subsidized coverage. And there, I think the provisions are the bills have different provisions. One bill allows for certain low-income workers or low-wage workers to go to the exchange and to weigh off that and to purchase coverage or acquire coverage in that venue. The other has a firewall which prohibits employees with an offer of coverage from going to the exchange and qualifying for subsidies. And I think that issue has not been resolved yet completely. From the firm's perspective, I think the other issue that we were worried about is that when we see the full set of policies being proposed, and if assuming things go forth, a savvy HR manager at a firm might ask whether the incentives created by pay or play and the generosity of the subsidies, can a firm lower its compensation costs and make workers better off, as well as the firm better off, by dropping employer-sponsored insurance and paying the penalty? And this is an issue that we don't actually have good research to model kind of the overall impact of employer dropping, but I think that it will be something that researchers will watch carefully. In particular, the incentive to drop employer insurance will increase as the generosity of subsidies increases and the pay or play tax decreases. And over time, this is going to be how these penalties are indexed and change with inflation, with medical inflation, are going to also affect behavior. Again, we don't have good research at this point, and I think that created a lot of difficulty for the modelers of coming up, the CBO and others, to arrive at what the magnitude of these effects might be in the near term and later. I also want to talk about the labor market impacts of an employer pay or play. So economic theory would argue that any new tax that's imposed on employers will be passed through to employees in the form of lower wages or slower wage growth. And so we expect that there may be modest reductions in employment, particularly among low-wage firms, to the extent that those employers can't fully offset those taxes or absorb those taxes by lowering workers' wages. I will say that an amendment in the markup did, in the House bill, I believe, did put in an employer hardship exemption to try to ameliorate this issue. We may also see changes in the structure of jobs, depending on the structure of a pay or play. There may be more shifting toward full-time work if that tax is a fixed cost, or part-time hours clustering at the threshold of what's defined as part-time. One concern we have is that there may be negative incentives around work hours for those who are eligible for exchange-based subsidies. So in the design of the subsidy schedule, if a worker goes from earning one income amount, and then if they work more, they exceed the income limit for qualifying for a certain subsidy, that marginal cost of an additional work hour could be very costly because they could lose a good chunk of their money relating to the subsidy for their coverage. So we worry about that. And we also think about early retirement behavior. So one of the big issues is that for early retirees, getting health insurance in the individual market is very difficult and very expensive. Rating reforms and other types of changes may help to make health insurance more affordable. We could also see labor force participation among early retirees or among those 55 to 64 decline as a result of having better access to coverage. And finally, on a positive note, we see that having a reformed individual market that is transparent and that functions more smoothly could help to reduce job lock and actually promote workers' productivity and job mobility, including entrepreneurship. So that's kind of the one very, very big positive related to the reform proposal. With respect to potential implications for states, as I said, it's possible there may be some modest employment losses to the extent that that translates into increased demand for unemployment insurance or other state assistance programs. I think states need to be made aware of that. In Minnesota, given our already kind of high insurance rate, I would suspect that that's not as big of an issue to worry about. We may see some personal income tax revenue effects as a result of employer regulatory requirements if, again, employers reduce workers' wages to offset or absorb the cost of pay or play provisions or to meet the minimum coverage requirements. We could see some decrease or slower wage growth. And as Lynn did a great job talking about, there may be considerable regulatory responsibilities around monitoring the entry of new health plans within and outside the exchange. But I would say, having read both of the draft bills, it's very difficult to interpret just how much states will be at risk, both from a regulatory standpoint and from a financial standpoint, regarding the implementation of reforms, particularly related to the exchange development. My final topic is that I'd like to talk about today is paying for healthcare reform. And when I was actually served on a resources subcommittee as part of the administration to try to brainstorm ideas around how to pay for healthcare reform. And we were charged with two main goals. One was to identify potential scorable savings from the Medicare and Medicaid programs that would address current program inefficiencies and that would not be politically difficult, political hot potatoes, as the insiders call it. And secondly, to identify potential sources of tax revenues that would not break campaign promises relating to the tax exclusion of employer contributions toward insurance and or imposing new taxes on families earning less than $250,000 per year. So as part of this exercise, those tasks that I just mentioned really tried to target the first objective, which I list, which is paying for the estimated $1 trillion cost over the budget window for the coverage expansion and other reforms. The primary expense of healthcare reform is the coverage expansion. But there was also a secondary objective that folks at the Office of Management and Budget and many of those on the economics team had, which was that we wanted to couple this with identifying strategies for slowing the growth of healthcare costs within the Medicare and Medicaid programs that would have subsequent spillover effects to the private sector. Those were things that were important to those who were in the administration as well as the committee staffs. Just to give you a sense of the pay-fors that are put forth in the House Tri-Committee bill, as you can see, the two buckets of financing or savers to the Medicare and Medicaid program, the net savings is estimated at about $219 billion over the budget window. That runs 2010 to 2019. And the big ticket items affiliated with those savings include a productivity adjustment to Medicare market basket updates. So updates to Medicare payment rates would be adjusted downward to reflect overall productivity growth in the economy. Second, there is some correction of overpayment to Medicare Advantage plans. That's also a very big ticket item. There are reforms to home health and other types of care within the Medicare program. There's also a reduction in disproportionate share payments. Again, as Lynn alluded to, with the rationale being that as you provide greater coverage to those who are now uninsured, you should need fewer resources to providers relating to covering the uninsured. And then finally, there is a Medicaid prescription drug rebate change as well. One of the big, I will mention the bottom bullet, which is payment reform for physician services. This is the House bill wanted to do something fairly comprehensive around fixing the sustainable growth rate formula that is in place to try to control spending for Medicare Part B for physician services. And so they put in a reform there. I did notice recently that they have now pulled that out in the numbers, in the calculations. They have moved that item off the reform kind of budget. So that's why it's in red. It's a coster, but it is being treated differently. The majority of the financing for healthcare reform will come from tax revenues, in particular the high income surcharge, which is expected to bring in $544 billion over 10 years. It taxes those with incomes in excess of $350,000. A smaller ticket item, but which is relevant for those who have health reimbursement arrangements, health savings accounts, and health flexible spending accounts, is that they're going to make some modifications to qualified medical expenses. It is actually difficult to find details on what exactly they're proposing, but that is listed in the Joint Committee on Taxation's report. One thing I wanted to mention here, so we talk a lot about numbers in the trillions. I think that was something, probably perhaps one of the greatest, biggest lessons I learned in working in D.C. is they round billions of dollars. But what I wanted to do was to break out the cost of reform by year to illustrate two points. One is that we start that reform is proposed to start collecting tax revenues. That's the red line, and making changes to Medicare and Medicaid starting in 2010. Coverage expansions are not slated to start till 2013. So in essence, you can see the trajectory of those lines through the budget window. The lines cross, and at 2019, we do see a gap in which the net impact of coverage specifications, that's the cost of coverage expansion, will exceed the identified funds to pay for health care reform. So while the proposal is deficit neutral in the budget window, on a year-by-year basis, it is not. And in fact, the CBO projects that costs will grow at 8% nominally relative to only about 5% per year for the revenue side of it, the tax revenues and the savers. So I think that that suggests all the more important that we emphasize and move forward on payment reforms, more fundamental delivery system reforms to deal with this. Peter Orszag, who I got to work with while I was in D.C., has a great quote: "Healthcare cost growth dwarfs any of the other long-term fiscal challenges the U.S. faces. Nothing else we do on the fiscal front will matter much if we fail to address rapidly rising healthcare costs." And so this parfait chart just illustrates what will happen, is projected to happen to spending on Medicare and Medicaid absent reform. So we'd expect that top portion of the chart will actually look, will actually shift upward with a coverage expansion. And so it does really bring to bear the need to slow the growth of healthcare costs. And as Lynn mentioned, I think that's something that will have to happen as we go forward with reform. I think coverage is important, but we all recognize as well that slowing the growth of costs is going to be also key to this long term. Is there still an economic case for healthcare reform? Perhaps because I spent, 2 months of my life working on this report, I'm kind of wedded to the idea that it is important to think about what are the benefits of improving the efficiency in the healthcare system, particularly around delivery. And I will say that Minnesota should be held up as a leader across the country, and in fact, folks in Washington believe that. There were many, many occasions in which they looked to Minnesota organizations, to initiatives, community-wide initiatives, as being vital or good examples of what can happen in terms of transformation. Basically, I think that it will be critical as moving forward that we consider that state experiments help to define and inform federal policy relating to delivery system reform, and that eventually we're going to need to change the game by slowing cost growth to make a strong economic case for dealing with our long run healthcare economy. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to invite Dr. Blewett to join you at the table now, and we'll take some questions. I'll start by just Dr. Abraham, your comments about the exchange and the way they're thinking about it in the bills in Washington, D.C., seem to imply that an employer contribution to the exchange is not being considered. When we thought about it, it was one of the things that we assumed would be happening in many cases where small employers were offering insurance, was that they would prefer to buy their insurance for their employees through the exchange and make premium contributions on their behalf. Is that an option that Washington, D.C. is considering?
So the exchange is designed for small employers and individuals without access to employer-sponsored insurance. I think the hope is that we can encourage more small firms, small employers, to offer insurance, and to the extent that they can get a better deal in the exchange, absolutely. I think that where we worry a little bit is that to the extent that some employers might find it more advantageous to not offer coverage, the cost of that will actually be borne by the government. But the payments themselves would go to a trust fund to help to finance some of the subsidies, or to finance the subsidies within the exchange for those low-income Americans.
A second question I have, and if neither of you can answer this, I certainly would understand. I haven't been able to get anybody so far to be able to answer it. But our Medicaid spend on people. We have a lot of elderly people and disabled people who, you know, spend part of their income today and then qualify for Medicaid to pick up the rest of their medical expenses. And, you know, some of those people are above, certainly a lot of them are above 100% of poverty. Some of them are above 133% of poverty. And the idea that private commercial insurance would meet all of their needs seems to me pretty remote. So is anybody thinking about what to do about that group of people and how they fit into this?
Senator Berglund, I think in some of the discussion has been in the bills, it's integrating Medicaid with the exchange and with the premium subsidies so that there's a seamless process. So if the eligibility were to, you know, the mandate for Medicaid eligibility would be 100% or 150%, I would imagine the spend down would move up as well.
We have Medicaid for people that are higher income than that? I mean, that's the thing I haven't been able to figure out.
It doesn't seem clear
mm-hmm. to me that we would, and mm-hmm. yet it would seem to me for some people we still need some kind of Medicaid wraparound for their private insurance. You know, just PCA mm-hmm. services, for example.
I think it's a really good, interesting point, and again, at the level of detail, we haven't seen much on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions members might have? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to see you. Is there a specific number of new agencies, or how many new agencies are going to be created on the federal side to do this healthcare reform, or is it how much of it is going to be the responsibility on the state? Can you give me a little better idea on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it's not clear sort of how many. There are a lot of discussion of commissions, advisory committees related to payment reform, related to quality measurement, related to essential benefit package. Those are all talked about at the national level to develop national standards. So in terms of new state agencies, none of the bills really specifies new state agencies except for the possibility of a state-based exchange.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Blewett, is there talk in this reform about prevention, whether you're looking at the chronic side of it, or accountability on the insured or the consumer? I mean, where is prevention in this whole discussion? Because I actually have not heard that much about it. And we have spent a lot of time in our healthcare reform in Minnesota on the prevention piece, the total package of prevention, and making the consumer aware of what he's spending and the quality versus cost, and on the chronic side.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there is some specifics. We didn't focus on this today, but we could come back with some of the more detail. There is some discussion about quality and quality measurement, and there are from the CDC grants that would go to states and or communities for prevention and wellness, similar to the CHIP program here, that they actually, CDC was here and got some information. And then there's also some provisions related to data collection around health status and health behaviors that would be more community-based as opposed to just national standards. So there are some provisions. It's really in, it's really deep down, and again, it hasn't really been discussed that much. Yeah, I don't know, Jean, if you wanted to add.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I will add that in the House Tri-Committee bill, there are actually a fair number of provisions relating to the essential kind of the minimum benefits package in terms of how much coverage of preventive services. There is language in there with respect to covering preventive services for Medicare beneficiaries and developing kind of a broader federal strategy around quality and prevention and kind of task forces for how best to motivate that, both with respect to coverage and behavior.
And kind of along those lines, is it envisioned that the quality standards would be developed federally, or would there still be room for things to be done at the state level like we are doing with ICSI?
Madam Chair, it's not really clear. The language is pretty national, federal focused at this point. Whether there'd be, you know, waivers or opportunities for states who have already had significant initiatives in this area, as long as they meet some kind of benchmark for review, so it really isn't clear at this point.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to both of you, doctors, can you give just a summary of if this national healthcare reform package does pass, how is it going to affect the what Minnesota has done with our reform? Because we have set the bar very high, I believe, and they should be looking at Minnesota as far as the reform. And we have been working on it for a long time. And I feel like this national reform package has been, you know, just a couple months, and we've got a package, and I'm nervous about that. So I'm very nervous about what it's going to do to Minnesota's agenda.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you know, we've been through this before where Minnesota's out front. For children's health coverage as an example, the national model was for CHIP, SCHIP was based on Minnesota Care, and then we already had our kids covered, so we kind of got the low end of the stick there because we were innovators. My guess is as they move towards, and Jean, you can help me with this, but I think as they move towards passing this broader framework and they get into the details of payment reform, peer grouping, use of provider data, the states really have, outside of Medicare, there isn't any other place where you could go to get how does it work and how did you approach it and how do you get providers to the table and what are the peer groupings. And so I would imagine that we would be part of those discussions as they move ahead. But at this point, that we're not at that level of detail. I don't know, Jean, if you agree with that.
I would concur with that. I think that, you know, I think the administration, I speak from, you know, having been at the administration's kind of perspective, I think that they're cognizant of states being in very different places with respect to healthcare reform and innovation. I think that Minnesotans need to push very hard to be present and have a loud voice as things develop. But they are cognizant of it, and but we just don't have a level of detail right now to be able to speak kind of definitively.
I know that several of the bills allow for pilot projects with states. for Medicare to be involved with payment reform and or for there to be waivers. I think in one of the bills there's waivers for Medicare to be involved with state reform. So I'm optimistic that even though they don't have a lot of details about it, that there'll be an opportunity for Minnesota to be kind of helping lead the way for other states. Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Blewett, is that how you pronounce it? Okay. Just a couple questions, just kind of a couple interpretations and then maybe a question. Exchanges, is that like just a giant pool that you, is it, how do, can you define exchanges for me?
Madam Chair.
Healthcare exchange.
Senator Coring. It's really a organizing entity that would review different insurance products and provide information that's easy to discern across the plans, which ones meet the minimum benefits, the affordable plan. And so it's more of an organizing entity as opposed to a pooling structure.
Mm-hmm. And then, Madam Chair, I'm hearing on the news that President Obama a month ago said that a public plan had to be part of the bill, mm-hmm. and now he just gave a speech and he says doesn't have to be in the bill, so he's kind of waffling on that. Can you explain what does he mean by that? What is public plan? What's that all mean? The farm boy.
Madam Chair. Senator Coring, the public plan would be a government-run health system. So similar to Medicare, you could think of Medicare as a public plan, or the VA, which is a more integrated system, as a public plan. So you would be eligible and receive services through, and the government would pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's caught up in politics right now, which is people are opposed to the public plan as a concept. And I think, I can't say what President Obama is thinking, but the politics of it is if he wants a bill, that might be something he has to give a little bit on, mm-hmm. because it seems to be one of the stumbling blocks, the public plan and the financing.
So, the state employee plan is a public plan, and that's how you have your insurance.
And, Madam Chair, I would just say that I have a phone message on my phone that I'd be willing to play for anybody that wants to listen to it. A gentleman called me, and his dad is a veteran, and he is not receiving the proper care from the VA here in Minneapolis, and he needs some testing done, and they said they told him that we're $10 million in deficit, and we're probably not going to be able to do this testing until next month. So, I think we should... the government taking over and thinking that that's going to be all good and well, look at the VA. They're not even taking care of our veterans the way they should.
But there would be a choice. People could be in a public plan or not be. They could choose private coverage.
What about, Madam Chair, if I can ask...
Veterans don't get that choice.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I can ask another question.
Senator Coring.
Dr. Blewett, you said... I can't remember where you said it, but you said that the seniors are, depending on what seniors make, they would pay more for their prescription drugs. Does that mean there's kind of a means testing in the bill, too? Is that? Can you expand on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, there are some provisions for wealthier individuals to pay more for their Part D premium. Yes. So it would be kind of a means test for higher income. So higher income, you pay more, as opposed to lower income, you get a subsidy.
Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair, just a clarification. That's for the prescription drugs?
Yes.
Not for the other coverage.
And then, Madam Chair, if I could, just a couple more questions, and then
Mayor
I'll be
Coring.
Done with mine. And then there was some numbers thrown around about the uninsured nationwide, 46 million, 17 million. Mm-hmm. What number is it, and which is a credible number?
Madam Chair, Senator Corrine, it's $46 million nationally is the standard that's used. It's developed by the current population survey, estimating the number of uninsured across the country. So it's $46 million. Those other ones were what would the uninsurance rate be if this plan was implemented as written today? So those are reductions in uninsured based on the specific proposals.
And then,
Senator Corrine?
Then, Madam Chair, this is so complex that does this mean if this passed, what would happen to our Minnesota care? Would we not have that anymore, or how does this all?
Well, I think it depends on how high they go on the income scale, but there would be folks in Minnesota care that would have the option to go through an insurance exchange and get a subsidy to buy an individual private insurance policy instead of being in Minnesota care. Or there would be other people that would have the opportunity to be in a public program like Medicaid instead of being in Minnesota care.
And then, Madam Chair, I guess this is a question to you. Does this mean that if the federal government, in its almighty wisdom, is going to take over all of our health care, does that mean that you and I are out of a job then, as far as this committee is concerned? Or?
I sincerely doubt that, Senator Corrine. I think as our witnesses have testified, if this passes, our work is just beginning. Mm-hmm. We will have a big role to play in terms of implementing it.
And then just one last comment is I don't know how we are ever going to pay for this. This is just, I hope the public speaks up. I know that I did my local county fairs and parades, and people are scared. They're scared of this, and they don't really want it. At least that's the people that I'm representing. So,
well, Senator Corrine, I would encourage you to be thinking about how we're going to pay for health care in the future if we don't do this. Because as you could see on the chart, Medicaid and Medicare spending and costs will continue to rise. And without some way of controlling costs in the whole healthcare system, we're not going to be able to control costs in that part of the healthcare system, I don't believe. Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that much of the conversation with the federal reform and much of the conversation here today has focused more predominantly on the issue of access, and I'm certainly appreciative of the fact that different states are in different places, and frankly, we are sitting pretty good in terms of access, generally speaking. But having said that, Dr. Abraham, one of your charts talks about the scorable savings from Medicare and Medicaid, and that is something that I think many of us are very interested in hearing more about, diving into a little bit deeper. Particularly in light of where Minnesota sits. And is there any additional information that you can provide to us, or summaries, or the work that's being done in that area? And I would say the same thing on the area of payment reform, recognizing that that seems to have taken sort of a side seat for the moment. I hope that it is noted that I do think Minnesota is leading in this arena, and that's a really critical component. As I sat here, and I appreciate Senator Corrine's comments about what he's hearing at his fair and his town hall meetings and things of that nature, I also was reminded of Senator Berglund's comment when we finished healthcare reform in 07, and when you signed your omnibus bill, and I think one of your comments was that you shared some disappointment that we weren't able to go as far as you had hoped that we would be able to go. And I think that that will probably be the outcome of the federal reform, but recognizing the very important step that is being taken and the work that's being done. And so if you could provide comment, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, thank you. So the Medicare and Medicaid savings is those reforms are an integral part of the financing. As I mentioned in the presentation, one of the major sources is to create a productivity adjustment as part of the Medicare market basket update. So every year, the actuaries at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services figure out how much to increase provider payment rates. So for hospitals, physicians, home health care organizations, and other types of provider organizations. And currently, physician services does already take, there is already an adjustment made for productivity growth. The idea or the concept behind this is that the economy is becoming more productive over time, so we get more efficient at doing things, and we can do more for less cost or the same cost. And the idea is that healthcare should be no different. We need to think about whether we can incorporate that into the payment updates so that we're not talking about a real cut. We're talking about not increasing their rate as much as it would be. Having said that, Minnesota tends to be a very efficient state, and so we're already pretty lean in how we produce healthcare, and so that type of instrument, which is kind of a straight kind of change across the board, unfortunately does not benefit Minnesotans or providers, I should say, within Minnesota as much as something that would have been more targeted. So those of us who were kind of in those discussions were much stronger advocates of looking at kind of the trying to create a reform that would actually target the geographic variation, the notion that in some parts of the country they spend a lot more per capita than in other parts of the country. And I think part of it is that the Medicare payment system is so complicated that it makes it very difficult to legislate. And I think they didn't want to invoke the political threat that would come with certain geographic areas being hit much harder than others. So they went from a simpler, blunter tool. The other big ticket item on the Medicare and Medicaid savings slide was the changing the way that Medicare Advantage plans are paid. These are the Medicare HMOs, the managed care plans. And the at issue there was the fact that there was a study by, I believe, MedPAC that indicated that Medicare Advantage plans were being were paying much more than it would have cost for those beneficiaries to be in traditional fee-for-service Medicare. And so the reform was put in to actually cut those payment rates to managed care organizations and private fee-for-service plans. And that would create some savings, basically to just bring it back in line with what those payments should be. So some would argue that's not so good for Medicare beneficiaries because they potentially could be affected through changes in the benefits that they get through their Medicare managed care plan.
Dr. Abraham, one of the things that I've thought about as I've thought about the disparity in Medicare payments around the country is whether there'd be possibility as we move in the area of reforming the Medicare payment system to reward quality and efficiency, if there could be a variation in shared savings so that, you know, if you're a low reimbursed area, maybe your providers would get more savings for their effort at reform, and if you're in a higher reimbursed area, maybe the federal government would get more of the shared savings. Has there been any discussion of that idea?
Madam Chair, with respect to Medicare, we did not, there was not much discussion around shared savings, but actually where that topic did come up, albeit no details and it did not really take foot, was around thinking about the issue of Medicaid long-term, about trying to think about ways to deal with Medicaid variation and containing cost growth. But as I said, let me emphasize, there's nothing in the federal health care reform package to speak to that issue today. That will be an issue that will have to be dealt with in the future, and that I think federal lawmakers are interested in whether there can be a win-win situation for both states and the federal government.
Senator Lynch, did you finish? Okay. Other questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, thank you. Dr. Blewett, in one of your slides, you have the numbers remaining uninsured, and I think I saw the House Tri-Committee said they were projecting 34 million people would have something that don't now. And mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think we can understate the importance of that, but the 17 million remaining, which is less than the other two bills are likely to be, is anybody there talking about universal, like getting the other 17 also? Because it is, I think that 17 million would leave them roughly the same uninsured rate nationally that we have now here, roughly speaking.
Roughly. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I think that's right. Early on there was discussion, and President Obama has been very firm about universal coverage. I think getting there is just too costly. So this is sort of what can we do now, and then expand later. Even with what they're doing now at $1 trillion, this is how far we can go. So to increase that coverage level would mean increasing the eligibility on the premium subsidy, Medicaid, or with the public plan option. So yes, there was discussion of universal coverage. I think this is the expedient, the political process at play in terms of balancing the objective and the budget.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, maybe Dr. Abraham, I don't remember which of you had the slide that talked about some of the payment, they had payment reform stricken payment cuts, and it talked about trimming payments to hospitals by $155 billion in an effort to spur efficiencies and so on. I was going to say I'm liking the fact that we're covering 34 million more people, but I'm also thinking that the way some of the savings are, well, we're going to pay hospitals less and they'll become more efficient magically somehow. I'm not convinced. I think that this is something for the short term we have to do, but I don't think that this is a route that's going to be sustainable, especially if you're doing it by, charging seniors more for prescriptions, some seniors more, paying hospitals less. I mean, that's not fixing it. That's shifting the cost in a sense. But.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I agree. And I don't know if you want to talk about the budget markings. I mean, they're looking for ways to get to that $1 trillion.
I think sometimes it's hard to score changing a payment method to generate changes in behavior that will generate savings. At least that's been my experience. And it's much easier to score cutting a payment methodology rather than changing the way we deliver services. Other questions? Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I apologize. I came in after you talked about the slide about people who will continue to be uninsured. And you probably covered this. But who are those folks? Who and why are they still going to be uninsured?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, those will be people that are still at either the 300 or 400% of poverty, but still cannot afford private coverage. So it's kind of the gap. Even with Massachusetts, there was a gap between, what the subsidy was and then what the affordable coverage was. So it's still not affordable for them to purchase. And so you can think of someone at between 55 and 65 who has a health condition, who doesn't have employer-based insurance, it still might be out of their range in terms of financing.
Thank you.
Senator Coring.
Oh, just one more question, Dr. Blewett. How is the Massachusetts plan working? Because I guess that's kind of the model that everybody's thinking is so wonderful. How's that working in Massachusetts?
Senator Berglund, Senator Coring, it has substantially reduced the number of uninsured from about 9% down to 3%. So in terms of coverage and access, it's made significant gains. I think they're struggling again with the affordability and again payment reform and how do we get more efficiency out of the system. So the costs are still going up, which means for everybody, including the subsidy programs, their costs are increasing. And so I think that now the effort is to really focus on cost containment.
But Madam Chair, it's my understanding that it's costing a heck of a lot more than they initially thought. So if this federal plan is $1 trillion and we're thinking it's going to be $1 trillion, mm-hmm. if it goes the way that Massachusetts is going, it's going to be way more than that, mm-hmm. way more than $1 trillion. You think?
Madam Chair, Senator Corrine, and I'll defer to Jean, but I think the CBO has taken, into account the experience of Massachusetts, because that's one place where they are doing similar things, individual mandate, employer mandate, the exchange. And so I assume that some of their assumptions were based on the Massachusetts experience. Now, whether the cost implications are in there, I'm not sure.
Other questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just a comment, Senator Coring, our Minnesota health plan would cover people less expensively. I think it would cover everyone. When Dr. Abrams said that Minnesota is pretty lean in how we provide health care, I will compare it to other states we are, but again, we're spending twice what most of the rest of the world spends to cover everyone. So I do think we ought to be looking at things that we say aren't politically feasible, because when what's politically feasible isn't economically sustainable, mm-hmm. we ought to be looking a different direction. And Senator Corrigan, I'd welcome your support again like you did 2 years ago.
Well, Madam Chair, I
think we don't need this conversation.
I offered my support just to bring
that idea
forward.
I would just like to say that if you did not get a handout, we apologize to the audience. If you want to email Shannon, we'll make sure that you do get one.
Madam Chair, we'll also have them on our website. So if you go to the SHADAC website, we'll have those posted this afternoon, so you can access them there.
We want to thank you both very much for the
yeah,
work
thank
that you,
you
did to help us understand what the discussion is about.
If you have additional questions or want us to come back with more specifics on a specific topic, we'd be happy
to do that.
Well,
we may when we see what we end up with.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. We have another presentation that's pretty important about reforming our state regional treatment center programs. So if you're not staying for that portion of the presentation, we'd ask you to quickly and quietly leave the room. And we'll ask Dr. Sulik to come up to the table and and Mr. Tesmer may want to join him.
Yeah, I'm
going to
have him join me.
Now, members, just to refresh your memory, we did in our budget bill have an item that was reforming services at Anoka Regional Treatment Center. So we're anxious to hear how the reform and the plans are going for Anoka. But in addition to that, the governor unallotted state-operated services with the idea that there would be further reorganization of state-operated services beyond Anoka. And so we're going to hear about both of those, but kind of as two different things so we can keep straight what's what.
Sure.
Dr. Sulik.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dr. Reed Sulik, Assistant Commissioner for the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration of the Department of Human Services. I've asked Mr. Mike Tesner to join me as well, just to be available for questions after I give you a brief overview of where we're going and what our status is. To start with, as Senator Berglund has indicated, there are two things that occurred that we're now, actually really three things that have occurred that we're really confronted with that parallel what's been going on since I've arrived at the Department of Human Services, which is really trying to create a design and transformation for our state-operated services system and how it can move into becoming more of a transformed specialty healthcare system. And so I'm just going to touch on that view as I walk you through our status. But just to clarify, there's three budgetary requirements that we've been charged to create. One is in the passing of the legislation calling for the Anoka redesign. There was about a $700,000 commitment out of that redesign in this next biennium that we have to account for. In the unallotment process, there's a $5.2 million commitment in the biennium that we have to that we're charged to account for in regards to the redesigning of our statewide state-operated services system and how we can transform our current array of services into an array of services that are more efficient. And I will walk us through the brief overview of this. My intention is this is going to be a very lofty and brief overview because we are in the process of the design at this point. What I want to touch on is probably four different things. The first is just to state that what we are currently undertaking is a development of a wide array of services to more appropriately provide levels of care to best fit the individual patient across the state of Minnesota, recognizing that the role of the state, as you've heard me speak to before, really is to provide care for those individuals with the highest degree of complexities. And these, and we are charged to provide services to individuals who have complex mental illnesses, addictions, and neurocognitive disorders that may include developmental disabilities or traumatic brain injuries. That process of looking at our ability to provide care in the most effective manner and in the most efficient manner, but to transform into an integrated healthcare system is really what we're undertaking in the process of the Anoka redesign and in the entire community behavioral health hospital redesign. What we are envisioning is the creation of a network of geographical adult care systems across the state and within the metro region, in addition to the creation of three highly specialized systems that serve the whole state. And those highly specialized systems would include the child and adolescent behavioral health services as one, the neurocognitive disorder services, which would be two, which would really be a merging of our traumatic brain injury services as well as our current developmental disability services that have been historically treated through MEDO and MSOCs, but trying to merge those programs together in a more efficient manner. And also our forensic services, to really see forensics is a very highly specialized service that we have that serves the entire state. The third point I want to emphasize is what does that redesign look like within each of these specialty systems or within a specific region? And it may include all or some of these nine types of services that we are examining and trying to look at the appropriateness of these services being available within the state system within these particular regions or specialties. One would be a specialized inpatient service. An inpatient psychiatric service. The second would be a specialized psychiatric residential treatment service. The third would be a specialized partial hospitalization program. The fourth would be a clinic and aftercare service. The fifth would be a consultation service. The sixth being using the role of our MSOCs program and our community support services system in a much more available consultation service that could be available not only to the state system but also to community providers. The seventh is looking at the chemical abuse and addiction recovery service being available to the entire array of services and within each of the regions identified. The seventh would be the appropriateness of academic affiliation. Other states have really moved years ago to a much closer affiliation with their academic partners in the state. The state hospital system historically is a system that really can improve its effectiveness and its sophistication when it's partnering with academic centers and becoming part of ongoing teaching programs. And then the last is really exploring the array of potential public and private business partnerships and other types of partnerships that could be occurring within our system so that we can achieve greater sustainability within the state system as well as our community sector as well. The process currently underway is the development of internal design work groups, action groups, and design teams exploring the redesign of ANOCA and then exploring the redesign of the entire state-operated services system. And then once there are some tangible products to come out of these, the work groups that are currently underway that include representatives from state-operated services as well as representatives from the three policy divisions, including the Adult Mental Health Division, the Children's Mental Health Division, and the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. We then have a process identified of obtaining statewide stakeholder input. And I'll refer you to this diagram that I put together to really help me explain to my employees and to our partners across the state an identified process of obtaining stakeholder input that can lead to more appropriate decision-making as I see it within the state system. And so we really are committed to being a person-centered process and really trying to engage the individuals that we ultimately serve, as well as their families and well as specific representatives. But then, in addition, there has to be an array of opportunities to obtain some pretty dynamic input from our clinical experts and professional societies, as well as our public policy members, as well as our own employees, as well as administration, as well as the financial input that's necessary to create a health system redesign that we're undertaking. I'll back up one step and just sort of walk you through sort of the design processes or the design teams that are currently in place, because there's several. We have seven design teams that were assembled this summer and that have been working diligently to examine the evidence base of appropriate practices and then trying to look at the potential fit within our state system. And that includes a design team around the service of specialized residential treatment service, because a specialized residential treatment service would be a service that is different than the current residential treatment services that are available in the state. This would be a psychiatric specialized residential treatment service that would really be considered a step up from the current intensive residential treatment services or the ERTs that are available. And this seems to be the greatest gap. You all have heard me, I believe, discuss this before when I've presented some of the locus data from the state-operated services system and also the gaps analysis that the state did, as well as our unmet needs study that the Adult Mental Health and Children's Mental Health Division were part of this past year. There's a work group around the creation of outpatient and aftercare services. There's a work group around our partial hospitalization program development. And there's a work group for care coordination. There's a work group around consultation services and how we can develop perhaps a statewide consultation team that's available not only across the state but available to the hospital emergency rooms and primary care clinics and community mental health care and addiction care providers across the state. And then a specific work group around the neurocognitive and disabilities services redesign. So, and that's more or less the lofty overview of where we're at right now. Several of the meetings have begun to obtain stakeholder input. Most of these meetings will be occurring in September, likely also in October, given the current demand to do this across the entire state. So I intend to be applying the same process of obtaining stakeholder input for the ANOCA redesign within the metro region as we are would be applying to the state-operated services redesign across the whole state. And if there's specific questions about that, you know, and about this particular diagram, certainly open to any of those. I'll just make a comment about the handout that you just received. There's a title. This was used in a half-day visioning work retreat with my administration yesterday, and I pulled this out of the PowerPoint that I used in that meeting, and so that's why it says the vision for 2015, which is basically us trying to come up with a very tangible five-year vision for the administration. So,
Dr. Sulik, first I just have a comment. And you joined the state of Minnesota just about a year ago.
9 months, to be exact.
Not quite a year yet. So it's just a little less than a year ago that I had you guys in front of my division talking about handcuffs at Cambridge and things like that.
Yes.
And at the time, I was trying to convince you that we could reduce our expenditures a little bit. And you kind of said maybe we could, and then you came back and said no, we couldn't. And we kept having that dialogue throughout the session. And, I never dreamed that we'd be talking about $5.2 million on top of what we did for Anoka. That's this biennium. It's an unallotment. Unallotments, I would remind you, are one time, and yet you're redesigning the system with the thought that it would become permanent, I'm sure. So maybe you could just tell us how the 5.2 was arrived at.
It's arrived at by looking at there's several things regarding the 10 community behavioral health hospitals that we have right now. One is, as you all are well aware, there's only four that are CMS certified and able to bill for federal dollars. When we went back and looked at the LOCUS data, and the LOCUS data, when I first met with you all and presented that data, which I believe might have been last November when I first arrived in the state, that pattern of the individuals with across the entire state system, about 25% of them meeting LOCUS 6 criteria, 50% of them meeting LOCUS 5 or LOCUS 4 criteria, and then the rest meeting a lower level of care criteria. And that was a pretty consistent pattern across the months. We kept that monthly analysis up for since then. We continue to obtain the LOCUS data. But that pattern is pretty static. And it has allowed us to continuously examine that and say, what can we do differently in a much more efficient manner to match the levels of care to the individual's needs? And looking at the utilization pattern of our community behavioral health hospitals and looking at if we had those four hospitals that are certified identified as our acute inpatient programs and the opportunity to convert the non-certified CBHs into specialized residential programs and develop a wide array of services that essentially could move in some way to making every bed that we currently would have in the state system a billable bed. I believe that's a reachable goal. And that really does change the financial picture of the state system becoming much more efficient. Also, if we look at programs that aren't currently certified, but if we can explore the potential business partnerships, public-private partnerships, where perhaps there's a community hospital that is really committed to a service being available in their region, and they essentially can assume the ownership of that program and contract with the state to run the program, it changes the billing options. So all of those factors were built in into multiple permutations that allowed us to come up with a model to achieve the savings that we were charged to come up with achieving. So I believe that we can do it. I'm not going to sit here and promise that it's going to be easy to achieve. This is an enormous undertaking, and it does call for an entire rethinking and redesign of our entire state system. I think the opportunity is ripe to do it in the right way, though. I really do.
So did you have a budget put together to achieve the $5.2 million? Did you build a financial model?
We did.
And then
right.
Offered the number up to the governor's office?
And the other thing to say is in our analysis of this, the potential revenue generated back into the general fund is pretty significant. Far greater than what we're contributing to the general fund at this point in time. So if this redesign is successful, and if we are able to successfully do the conversion of community behavioral hospitals that aren't certified into billable beds, there's a significant potential revenue generated back into the general fund that doesn't come back into the department, that doesn't come back into state operated services, that revenue collected goes to the general fund.
So is the revenue that is going to be generated part of the 5.2? Because
no,
this
we
business
able
of unallotment is pretty murky to me, at
right.
least. And
we were not able to
so
claim
that,
credit.
That is a general fund gain.
That's a general
separate
fund
from
gain.
Your budget.
Right. and we were not able to claim any credit for that proposed revenue and improvement to the general fund at all. But what I can say is this redesign leads to that. It leads
to I understand that, and so maybe potentially in the future we can do something about that, maybe.
Exactly. Right.
But the 5.2, I guess I'd be interested in having you give us a copy of that projected potential budget.
I don't think that there's anything that would prohibit us from being able to share that with you. So, I mean, essentially at this point, it's based on...
We're talking about public money, and
right.
We are the ones that appropriate, and
I'm just trying to show it to us now
or you can show it to us later.
Yeah. Well, I don't have it with me. But I'm just thinking that I would have thought that you had seen that by now.
No.
Okay.
Mm-mm. We'd also like to see the revenue projection.
Yeah, that's, Madam Chair, that's easy to provide.
Are there other questions, Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair and Dr. Sulik, so through this redesign and through this, what will be almost a $6 million cut, What will the impact be on the patients that are currently being served? That is, do you anticipate that you will be able to continue to serve the number of people that you are currently serving? And what impact will that have on future enrollments?
I believe, honestly, Madam Chair and Senator, that the ability to serve our patients better is accomplished by redesigning the system. You know, one of the difficulties is if you look at individuals who have very complex care needs, to provide only inpatient services available to them is not the right approach. And what this calls for is the development of a much wider array of services available to those individuals that have these high complex care needs. Some individuals may be decompensating to the point where they have some safety issues that they could be served very appropriately in a specialized residential setting, who may need longer period of stay for stabilization, but who don't need to be in a locked inpatient acute psychiatric care facility. And this may allow us to be able to provide and service to that individual without them having to come into an inpatient facility first. So that's one of the, and that's one example of many that I can give you that says.
Well, and that was the premise of the Anoka redesign.
Absolutely. And
the Senate work done.
It's essentially applying that to the entire state.
The rest of it is
state.
A little harder to understand since we sort of got rid of the regional treatment centers in rural Minnesota already.
Madam Chair, if I can clarify that, though, if you think about this, it shouldn't be, because one of the difficulties with ANOCA is it's currently an institute of mental disease. So I'm restricted from being able to bill federal dollars on that campus under the current structure. If in the healthcare reform they did away with the IMD ruling, that could help all of us tremendously. We wouldn't be having this conversation, I'm sure, because it would solve part of the issue of how you sustain these programs and being able to collect appropriate federal dollars. But that's what we're locked into at the Anoka campus. So the Anoka campus has to be thought of. I mean, we have to take a different approach. We have 16-bed facilities in the state currently. Across the state, that we're not locked into an institute of mental disease issue with those programs, so it's we can achieve a much faster rate of redesign and conversion of those facilities than we can from the Anoka. And if you come back to the Anoka redesign model that we presented to you, in the next biennium, there's significant projected savings if we can truly accomplish some public-private partnerships, so that if there's a health system on the West Metro side that has a unit that is able to bill appropriately for that unit, and it's not locked into the restrictions of billing on an Institute of Mental Disease campus. You know, those are the kind of things that we can't achieve with the rate that we can in the outstate area because we have the campus issue at Anoka. But if you look down the line, we projected that those savings would be present in the next biennium because we anticipate that it'll take time to get to that point.
Right, but we are not taking time to get to the 5.2 million. That's this biennium, and I am still not clear. You know, maybe when you give us the budget that you put together, we'll have a better picture.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to sit down with you individually or any of you all individually, come back and present that budget to you if that would be helpful. And I think it'd help clarify some things of what we're projecting.
I guess the other question that in regard to the Anoka portion of the reorganization, we were going to be doing that reorganization using state employees. Is the rest of the reorganization going to be done using state employees also?
We have a skilled and trained workforce that we intend fully to use as best as we can in this process. One thing that happens in the states, at the state, the outstate level, is these programs are going to be converted to, some programs may be converted to a specialized residential setting. The staffing patterns are different. Staffing.
I didn't say people wouldn't have to change their job.
Right.
I said, are we going to be using state employees to do the job?
Yes. So if we were to create a public-private partnership, our intention is that in that public-private partnership, that however the business, whatever the array of menu items of potential business partnerships there are that can be created, what is a prerequisite is they're using the state employees to run the inpatient program or the residential program. That's our intention. That's how we can make this work.
And I guess another question that I have, and I realize this is a little bit off the topic, but since some of us between now and next session are going to be working on trying to figure out what to do about general assistance medical care, I'm wondering what the loss of general assistance medical care will mean to your part of the Department of Human Services, since we have a fairly large number of people being served in that program that have mental illness.
And,
so if they're not going to continue to get their medications, if they're not going to continue to be able to visit their physician, whatever, then I would think that that would mean that there would be some impact on you, on your services.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we have kept on the table is the fact that we have to make sure that we have the ability to flex according to utilization demands. And so as we redesign programs, and one of our intentions is not to lock us into a structure that doesn't allow us to increase our capacity if necessary. Increasing capacity as necessary hopefully can be done with some efficiencies. If we look at the private sector, that's what private health systems have to accomplish. They have to be able to meet increasing demands and increasing flexibility in demands. So know that we're very much aware of the potential loss of the general assistance, GAMC, and the vulnerability of a number of those individuals who have mental health issues, and will that increase the utilization in areas of the state? We expect it's certainly possible. That's on the table, and our staff have been very actively involved with the healthcare administration as they have those discussions as well.
So you would be able to serve an increasing number of people if needed be because of the reduction or the elimination of general assistance medical care within a $5.2 plus million reduction in appropriation.
Madam Chair, if we are successful in improving our ability to collect revenue for the services we are providing, then, I mean, that is not something we're doing as widespread as our intentions are at this point. And that should help offset an increased demand for providing services for those individuals without any form of or ability to pay. So that's part of the projection.
Well, I am not trying to discourage you all, because obviously I was trying to get you to go someplace similar to this. But I do remember that when the governor's budget was modifying GAMC, not eliminating it as the veto did.
Correct.
It had accompanying it an increase appropriation for state-operated services, which the veto didn't have with it.
Correct.
So I think the questions that I'm asking are not figments of my imagination, and I'm not exactly feeling comfortable with the answers I'm getting. I just need to say that.
Madam Chair, what I can tell you is that we are very much aware of these issues, and what I'm assuring you is that they're on the table as we have these discussions. How are we going to solve for this? I mean, that's one of the things that everybody in this room is trying to figure out. How are we going to solve for that particular issue? It affects my administration significantly. So it's always on the table.
Other questions? Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm just trying to visualize the reorganization a little bit. When you're talking about the public-private partnerships, are you talking about a place like ISJ Mayo in Mankato might use its psychiatric unit to fill in some of the services for the those who would typically be going to a 16-bed unit that now is being utilized for one of the specialty services?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think in response to that example, I think that potential public-private partnerships, let's say ISJ and Mankato, we have a certified 16-bed CBH in St. Peter. So we're not as in need of looking at a formal business partnership there as we may be in a community that doesn't have a certified CBH. If that community was really, if that was the only psychiatric care facility in that community, and there's a couple regions in the state that are like that. That particular region is served pretty nicely in that we have a region where there's an inpatient adult community hospital program at ISJ. There's the state CBH program. There's also a state care program. We have a crisis program in Mankato, but what we're looking at is trying to figure out how we can have crisis beds available across the state appropriately and use, say, a residential program. So perhaps that Mankato program would be best served to become a specialized residential program that has crisis beds available, for instance. That's part of the redesign process. How it may look very different in one region compared to the next, depending on the array of needs that region has. I mean, if we look at this at the state right now and we look at where our programs are, what we have to do is go through this process in each of the regions and try to get the local stakeholders to provide us the input on what's going to be the best fit in that region.
Dr. Suluk, when do you expect you will begin the transformation? What kind of timeline should we be looking for?
I think if you go back to the Anoka redesign legislation and the materials that went into the background for that, and the same process with the unallotment process, having a realistic expectation that we have to go through the planning process, the stakeholder input process. First year of this biennium, we don't expect to see a significant change in services, but in really the development of the plan and the process and creating the timeline for transition in various programs and rolling it out across the next, over the two-year period. So that tiering of change was built into the projections, just at Anoka as it was with the CBH change. I expect that if we can be successful in completing a program design and have felt successful in achieving the right degree of stakeholder input and have the acceptance of that across the state, we should be able to have this started within the next year, but certainly not completed at that point.
So is there a projection of what the $5.2 million in savings becomes in the next biennium? Similar to what we did with Anoka, we projected some small savings this biennium and then larger savings in the next biennium?
Madam Chair, the projection change in the next biennium is a significant improvement, actually, in revenue collected as a result of the wider array of services. There was some additional savings, but not that dramatically different than what's projected that would be accomplished by making the change in the first biennium. The real change was a significant improvement in projected revenue collected in the next biennium. I'll walk you through those numbers when we can have.
Yeah, I guess I don't understand, because even if there's additional revenue collected, if you're not implementing most of the 5.2 until the second year. I mean, you have 5.2 less in revenue to pay for your operation, and if you're implementing most of that in the second year, it would seem to me that it would at least double in the next biennium.
What we're, Madam Chair, what we're presenting here is that there's opportunities to achieve efficiencies, and that's what we've been charged to accomplish. And I'm going to be the steward of these state dollars and do our best, absolutely, to improve the care, yet by achieving the efficiencies we've been charged to achieve. There's
room for efficiencies. You understand what I just said to you?
Right, and my response is that we can pull this off.
If most of it's going to happen in the second year of the biennium, and you're going to achieve a $5.2 million reduction in expenditure, then for the next biennium after that, it should be over 10, because you've gotten the 5.2 on a one-year basis. In the next biennium, you have it on a two-year basis.
Right. Madam Chair, just to go back to what I said earlier, there was a projected increase in savings. I don't know the exact figure off the top of my head in the second biennium, but what I had said is that there's a projected additional increase in savings in the next biennium. The real change is in the projected increase in revenue. I don't want to quote numbers because I'm pulling them from memory, and I don't want to misquote that. So I'd be happy to get the exact figures for you. But what I can tell you is that was part of the projection, that you'll see that.
All right. Well, we'll await the numbers that you have on paper, and
all right,
we'll appreciate getting them. Are there other questions? Thank you both very much,
yep,
and good
thank
luck
you
to you.
Thank you.
Meeting's adjourned.
So, pretty good line of questions.
Well, and of course, we worked on it all.